let's continue with primary financial statements.
Thank you, Hans. Moving on to agenda paper 21B, and it is a first one, so it's Yuki's first paper, and she's going to introduce the questions.
Right. So in December 2016, the board decided to explore the possibility of developing templates or examples, and agenda paper 21B discusses relevant options in more detail. We think even if the board decides to develop templates or examples, it could not be mandatory. So from paragraph 13, we analyze advantages and disadvantages of developing non-mandatory illustrative examples and recommend that the board to develop such illustrative examples. So the first question on page 6 is, does the board agree with the staff recommendation that the board should develop non-mandatory illustrative examples that accompany a revised IS-1?
I am not too sure it is really beneficial for us to develop template. I think template may be helpful. However, if we have templates, the entity may concentrate on thinking what category do you belong to. So, for example, if we provide financial institution template for financial institutions, so then once you think you are a financial institution, then they will think that they have to use that template. So that is not what we want. We don't want to prevent them from considering what is the best presentation. The presentation itself should be an outcome rather than following the template. So that is the danger of providing templates.
Just to clarify your point, Tuck, when you say template, do you mean non-mandatory illustrative?
Non-mandatory, even though it's non-mandatory. But as long as there is a template, and this is the template for financial institution, so then the mentality of the preparer would be, because I am a financial institution, I have to use this template because others, our peers, will use it. So eventually, it will become a norm of using that template. Otherwise, you cannot achieve comparability. So that kind of mentality would work between the preparers. So that is the one of the big disadvantages of providing template, especially it was provided by ISB. And actually, say, for example, financial institution, the business is keep diversifying. So even the financial institutions have other services. So those services could be quite significant. However, as long as there is a template, it will prevent them from considering what is the most faithful representation. So that is the point. I don't think the template is very beneficial.
I did consider the points that Tuck is raising, but I don't agree with that. I think the templates will be beneficial. I agree with the staff's suggestion that they're non-mandatory guidance. People can innovate with them as they wish, and our past experience suggests that is precisely what firms do, because we put out templates before. Also, we ourselves in the board have found the templates useful and helpful as we've tried to think through this project. And that's why I think they'll also be useful for preparers as they see our thinking and how the templates, how the structure of the performance statement would work for various industries.
Daryl.
I agree with Anne. I think templates are useful. I think they are, even when you apply the standards with the best judgment and the best will in, there often is more than one way that you can achieve the outcome the standard's looking for. And as from an ex-preparer perspective, I know we look for guidance to get an understanding of how to do things. I know as people have implemented I4F 17, they've looked at things like our effects analysis to get a feeling and an understanding of how they might do it. I think one of the difficulties we're going to have with this is I think we're probably not going to drive practice as much as we would like, because I think once existing practice is enshrined, people will sort of stick with what they're doing, because they're comfortable with that. But I think it's particularly important when new stuff comes out that we give assistance. And I think people do look for guidance. To Tuck's point, I think it is really important that we make it clear that this is not mandatory, so that people understand this is not the checklist type of thing that we've been trying to move away from in other places. But I do think that this can provide very useful guidance for people to think about the way that they apply the various guidance they receive.
Changu.
Thank you. Tuck raised a very interesting question on the peer pressure.
Yes.
Even though there's a non-authoritative guidance templates, yes. Peer pressure might, you know, drive firms to get kind of a uniform, yes. You know, presentation. That's very interesting. Let me ask Gary. You know, maybe Gary has some experience in the U.S. under the similar situation. Their SEC provides all kind of templates to all kind of U.S. companies. Are there any kind of peer pressure? It indicates that's a kind of mandatory, right? U.S. SEC templates.
No, I think by peer pressure, you mean a preparer versus a regulator.
No. Or among preparers.
Amongst preparers.
Financial institutions, others.
Yeah, I think in my experience, the specialized industries, they tended to talk to each other, and there really was not a lot of benefit from getting away from the herd, and you're kind of all in the same place together. The only people who might get a benefit are the industry leader, and they set the template for the industry, and which means they got to get it out there first. Is it insurmountable? No, but it's there. But it's, I think it's a consideration as opposed to a motivation. Comments later, you want me to keep going? Or
yeah, okay. Got it. Keep going.
By the way, I should say, Ada, you and the team, very well-written set of papers, as we would expect from you guys. But this is one where actually I've changed my mind on the role of templates over time. I've been against it for the last 2 years, but with all the tax reservations which I have, I think we probably should do it. Yet I think in this project, you take Disclosure Initiative and a few others, we're making a lot of changes to what the primary statements look like, and I think it's useful to get them in one place, especially when you read that schedule. It says, you know, for the various subtotals, if you're in an investment company versus a bank assurer, you know, some got the checks and some got the X's. I think it's useful to get templates down. Big concern would be, and where I thought Chung Wu was going, but went a little bit different place, is how do you make sure it's not mandatory or interpreted to be mandatory. Until your former life, when our counterparts in the States would write an example, it was hard to get off that example. But nonetheless, I still think this is worth doing. It's only going to be a due process document. I think, Ada, I would probably ask the question in it to respond is, do you believe these are best in, I guess, amended IS-1? Or better, say, in a practice statement. Again, I'm worried about the non-mandatory and how much pressure there'll be on it if it's an authorized standard. But it doesn't necessarily change the content. Just
you think
change.
It makes a difference whether it is a practice statement or
I do. And I think it separates it from the standard. But it's still out there in an IFRS document to give guidance. I do. I don't know if everyone would feel that way. So I just think it's worth just asking the question.
Not a bad idea.
I would assume it's going to IS-1, but I think it's worthy of asking the question. Is practice even better?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I also support that we provide examples, but I think we need to have a lot of cautions in the wording. I don't know whether it would be in the basis for conclusions or around the examples themselves and maybe both. So that the disadvantages that you highlight in your paper do not materialize, like people feeling, in fact, the need to strictly adhere and not necessarily enrich the statements in the way they should. The other use that I would find for these examples would be to help, in fact, have a form of field test of our proposals. Maybe in parallel to the end of our deliberations and or when you start drafting, because they may raise a number of questions that people would have if they followed basically what we've done, what we've decided. This is illustrated. And the first time these illustrations have been part of our agenda papers, they have helped people to understand better where we were heading. So they've shown already their usefulness, by the way. But I think we would get a number of useful reactions. I'm not talking about getting comments as to whether our decisions are good or bad. That's for the consultation period. But more the questions as to how do I move from what I do today into and implement the decisions with these illustrations. And it might help us have a few sweep issues before getting into the consultation stage.
Mary?
I think it's very important that we have some kind of examples, because certainly as we've been working on this project, I have at times found just the abstract written version of the requirements hard to visualize. And when you have, as you've been doing all along, give us examples, I'm like, okay, now I get it. Now I see, how they relate. So I think that is very important for people, for us communicating our ideas in both words and, illustrative examples. I also feel quite strongly in response to question one that they should not be mandatory, and we should not be saying we are setting out the templates that companies should use. I think I was looking to see if I could, this is maybe anticipating question two or three, suggest a couple that we could drop, because I think I remember somebody once saying to me, don't build a Rolls Royce, build a Ford, for something, do you really need the best, most complete version? When I look at these, I think we probably do need all of the, I think it's eight that you've enumerated in paragraph 23, but I think we also should recognize that we're kind of doing a commitment to keep them updated if we amend the standard or we make amendments to other standards that are relevant. So we should be looking to do the minimum we need to do rather than the most complete set that we need to do. But I think, I think you've got the right approach to these examples outlined in the paper. And then just I like Gary's idea of testing in the invitation to comment whether it would be better to take some or all of these out. You may need to one, so again the words come alive, but take some of these out and put them in something like a practice statement. I think that's a good question to ask. And the other thing is, when you're building the examples, I think it would be great to simplify it as much as possible by, let's say, having a non-financial entity example, a bank example, and then when you get to the ones that more than one business activity, you're saying, okay, let's say the one from example one is actually part of a larger group, so we aren't, reinventing lots of new scenarios.
Sue?
I also agree with trying this idea, asking for comment, the non-mandatory. I think Gary's idea about asking a question about location is a good one. To me, it feels like it shouldn't make a difference, but maybe it does, so let's hear. I was very happy to see the reference to the taxonomy, because I think it would be good to think about that at the same time, so we've got tagging in mind. I guess the only thing that I think we should be very careful about is that if this works the way that we hope it would, we'd be hoping this will give a strong steer to people about how they might think about their choices on presentation. So if there's particular things that we're very keen on being shown as separate line items or being shown in disaggregation, we should probably think carefully about them and make sure we've thought about what we should include if we want it to be an example of sort of best practice. But on the same sort of in contrast to that, I think we also need to be careful to make as clear as we can with our messaging that these are non-mandatory and that we're not sort of opining on anything in here about further disaggregation or more aggregation, that people might need applying the general principles. So it's not as though you now just do this and you turn off your brain and you don't think about any of the other stuff that we're going to be talking about in this project, and just so making that clear as we can. But I agree with the idea.
Dan Chow.
Thank you. I also agree with staff's proposal. I think why we need those templates or examples, or even why we discuss so many times about what the line items should be included in the statement, financial statement, subtotals should be included, all relevant to those formats, those structure of the financial statements. So also one of the big reasons, if we look at those financial statements prepared by those IFIs adopters, many companies declare that they apply IFIs, but if you look at the structure, format, and the line item or subtotals of those companies, there's still significant difference there. I think it's not helpful for the users, for the regulators, to understand why they're using same accounting standard, but results in different representation or format. So I think introduce some examples, templates, could really contribute to the greater, comparability. And also Sue mentioned that if we are going to develop a high-quality IFI taxonomy, we do need this kind of example, those templates in place first. Then easy for them to develop the element and develop the taxonomy as well, and facilitate the electronic report. So I agree with this proposal. With regard to tax concern, the good thing is that we propose that it's non-mandatory, and also staff mentioned it will be, we will using, principle-based approach, and then allow the preparers sufficient flexibility to present their statement in a way that reflects their business activities, and therefore would be useful for users. So I agree with staff's proposal. I think it's a good step for us to work on this. If we don't do so, those national standard setters or regulators will step in. They will develop different kind of templates, and I think it will not help for us to enhance comparability worldwide.
I like Gary's suggestion of possibly putting it in a practice statement. It would at once make it clear that it's non-mandatory, but it will also increase the visibility of the templates at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, I would write the due process documents as if it will be an IAS-1, but then you still ask the question.
Okay, well, who supports the statute recommendation?
13.
Right. Okay. Just a question. Any reaction to possibility of field testing?
Of what?
Field testing.
Field testing.
Something to do that as part of the outreach comment.
If I could jump in, it's a separate process. I would just worry about it delaying how long we take. But I think through the due process document, we would be able to get feedback in that way. And as you pointed out, what the staff has been doing is through various consultative group meetings, they've been providing examples of what some of our tentative decisions look like. So they have been getting feedback in that forum as another form of field testing.
Having said that, it's probably something we can really only consider once the board decides what should be the next consultative document as well, because I think that also drives a little bit the type of activities we do and how we do them.
I know. I was here first. I was fast. No, just, Francois, I don't think I would field test before we got to an exposure draft.
Or a document.
Or a document, even in exposure draft. I think having examples out there and trying not just to get general feedback, but to say one of the things we, in effect, like to do is kind of a field test of application of the requirements would be a good objective for the consultation and outreach on a package of proposals. Yep. But I don't think I want to start field testing things before we go out, before we have a complete package.
But I'd build And I'd agree with Mary that I think it helps us explain the proposals as well. So I think it's a helpful facilitator for the general due process anyway.
Also, just to clarify, because it depends what you mean by field testing, because in my view, we have been field testing actually each one of these board papers we're bringing to you because we discussed them. You know, we go check what the practice is, we talk to companies to the extent, you know, practicable, what effect will be. So it's a process. So I just, you know, it really depends what you mean by this exercise. And but yeah, that's on discussion for now, I guess.
But you mentioned that. Have you really done that? You have tested the statement with banks and with insurance companies, with investment companies. Man, how many have you?
We have spent extensive amount of time in last two meetings with our consultative groups, with GPF and CMAC, were very much focused. We had a long sessions with them, which focused purely on the effects of the proposals we have so far. And this was accompanied by discussions with some of them before the meeting, after the meeting, follow-up, and it's something that's in process. I'm not saying, Martin, to your point, that we have gone and tested each one of the aspects of the proposal. Clearly, that's not practicable at this point, and this is where the formal field testing would come on. But even for insurance, for banks, you know, we are now doing additional round of outreach to help us refine the proposals and decisions you've made in September. So we are doing, but we're not doing formally, as maybe this is what Françoise and Mary meant when you asked the field test, where we go out and, you know.
And ask the question, because man, I have not agreed to that, because I think it is not workable. But you said now you have done kind of tests with Bankman. I would be interested in the result of that, because that is my reason why I think it is not.
Well, and in fact, if I may add something, having, you know, people questioning how they're going to implement may highlight that our proposal needs some refinements here and there. And I don't know what document we're going to issue, but in the event we would decide for NED, I think it would also help us prevent the risk of exposure. And doing that during the drafting phase is a way of not delaying anything unduly. So I see a number of benefits, because I don't think we have gone to, you know, to having people really see the kind of questions and difficulties they would encounter in implementing. We may have a number of SWIP issues to consider before going to the consultation document. But I mean,
maybe this is something that we could actually address when we get to the EDDP question, because I think there are different considerations to ED versus DP. And even if we do go to an ED, I think there are questions over to what extent we actually need to do field testing, and whether we, before we issue it, or whether we could actually cover what we need to cover as part of the outreach on an ED. So perhaps we could pause this conversation until then.
Very good. Thank you.
Right. The next question is about the scope. We recommend that examples should generally cover the areas most affected by the project and not a complete set of financial statements. Therefore, in paragraph 19, the staff recommend that the board develop illustrative examples or documents. Examples for the statement of financial performance, the statement of cash flows, and any notes that are introduced or amended by the project. We also recommend including several examples of statement of financial performance listed in paragraph 23 and included as question 3. These are based on illustrations of effect of the proposals on scope of subtotals included in agenda paper 21B for the September board meeting, included as Appendix B to this paper as well. The staff would like to highlight that these are only a starting point and further work will be needed, including to reflect any subsequent board decisions, such as how to describe subtotals. So we would like to ask you questions 2 and 3 together here. Question 2 is on page 7. Does the board agree with the staff recommendation to develop illustrative examples for A, the statements of financial performance for different types of entities, D, the statement of cash flows for financial and non-financial entity by updating the current illustrative examples, and E, any notes that are introduced or amended by the project. And question three is on page 9. Does the board agree with the staff recommendation to include illustrations for the types of entities listed in paragraph 23?
I agree with the staff recommendation here. With the thinking of what illustrations we should have, I think it would be good to have a direct link between these illustrations and the outcomes of the flowchart that you are preparing. So mirroring, linking the two would, in my view, be useful. So depending on the outcome of that one would have an impact on that answer. I would continue with a few questions. When we made the decision that the common starting point for the cash flow statement would be, at the time it was profit before investing, financing and tax, we had not yet made the decision on the distinction between integral and non-integral joint ventures. Do you intend to come back so that the starting point would be operating profit?
Frank has written the paper already.
Okay.
We're just pacing ourselves.
And I wanted to make sure, because I think from time to time I forget to ask this type of questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, yes.
Basically, I agree with staff's proposal, just to have some question or observations. First question about notes. Yeah, I whether we're developing examples, including, you know, the face of financial statements only or include notes. I look at the question two, actually, we're going to have both. But for the face of financial statements, they were including all the, you know, line items and subtotals, not only limited to the decision we made on this project, but with direct notes, only limited to those notes introduced and amended by our project. So I'm thinking whether they could be matched each other. So the question is whether the note, we should develop the example for notes. If we decide to develop examples for notes, how many things should be included in notes? Whether only limited to what you said, that those introduced or amended by the project, I think it's very limited, only provided very limited useful, you know, information, useful format to the users, because normally they develop notes as a whole package, the companies. So I think this is the first question I would like. I have no solution, but I'm thinking about that. How can we deal with those notes if we are going to develop the examples for them, template? And the second question about develop the templates for different industries, different companies. The first, we are going to develop a template for a non-financial entities. I have not tested this kind of idea, but I'm thinking that even for non-financial entities, maybe those entities are manufacturing, non-tenants, are commercial or travel agency, maybe their business activity also quite different, just like non-financial and non-financial. So I'm not sure whether one template can fit all those different kind of non-financial industries. I think maybe it's possible we can explore further. And the second, about paragraph 23D, about the template of banks, we use the term of a traditional bank with no material investing activities. I'm not sure whether we are trying to illustrate that those traditional banks, normally there will be no material investing activities. If so, I would like to delete traditional, just a bank with no material investing activities, because when we mention the insurer or other activities, we will not mention traditional or modern, something like that. Just clearly defined, not the traditional. Because in practice, it's very difficult to define what's the traditional bank or what's the modern bank. Yeah, so yeah. So this is the second. And the last is actually relevant to my first observation with regard to a non-financial entity. The proposal we proposed in paragraph 23F, that is relevant to an entity engaged in more than one business activity. Then we're using a specific industry that is a manufacturer, not other non-financial entities. So I'm we are going to focus on specific industry or all other non-financial entities, something like that. So yeah, just a couple of questions.
Can I respond?
Observations.
So the first question, as I understood, was we are proposing a set of examples in question two, but then in question three, we are setting only a number of different examples for illustrations of statement of financial performance for different entities. And I think you were questioning where do notes come in there. And, you know, just to clarify, so the question three is about a subset of the bullet A in question two. So what we are saying is that for illustration of statement of financial performance, because we have principles for the scope of subtotals that will lead different types of entities into different subtotals and different items in different subtotals, we thought it's useful to have a number of different illustrations. And back to Françoise's point, illustrating different outcomes in the flowchart, we are preparing to illustrate that scope. So that is intention with that. And now items B and C in question two, we as a staff did not think it was necessary apart from FI, non-FI for statement of cash flows, but for the notes, and when we say notes, we're thinking around management performance measure, unusual and infrequent items. We didn't think it was necessary to prepare a different variant of those. I mean, yes, of course, they will look different between different entities, but they will look different between different entities and different industries, depending on what they identify, if they identify MPM. So we thought it's sufficient to just have a example or two examples there, but for statement of financial performance, we wanted to elaborate, linking into the different outcomes we can have with respect to the scope of subtotals. And maybe then to your question on 23A, why one non-financial entity? And I think really the reason for that is I don't like the word template, because template illustrates something you follow, and here it is. These are illustrative examples, and they are there just to illustrate the ideas the board have, the approach. They're not there to prescribe how you do, and that's the whole reason we did not recommend and you agreed not to have anything mandatory, because if we went down the mandatory route, I agree with you, we could not have 23A. We would have to have 23A, A to A, Z, because there are so many different variants. But we think for the purpose of illustrating general ideas, we could probably try to manage to, you know, to Mary's point, simplifying things, perhaps through nature and function, but recognizing that this is not going to capture all variants. And then, you know, traditional bank, we just kind of kept the wording that we used in September board papers, but of course, you know, we will revise that. And similar for the multi industries, and, you know, we take on board the comments. The idea is not to overcomplicate things, but just have enough there to illustrate the different variants of the scope outcome that we have based on September board decisions.
Just to add something there, because I'm not sure whether you answered Jingxiao's question about the notes, because I've misunderstood what the question was. But was your question, why are we only illustrating a limited number of notes rather than all the notes to the financial statements?
Yep. Yeah, yes, you're right. Actually, we didn't discuss this issue before. What's the scope of notes? We are going to provide examples for them. Only very limited numbers of notes, such as managing performance or other item out, or whether we should, we could give, you know, a comprehensive some examples. Just yeah, clarify that thing. Yeah.
Yeah, I think
the decision here is that just very limited. I think very limited. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was our intention, was to limit it to those notes that we would be introducing or amending as part of this project. And I think our reasoning behind that was that to actually develop a full set of notes for each of the illustrative financial statements would actually be a really significant exercise that would take us a significant amount of time. And we're not sure whether we would actually get sufficient benefit out of doing that to actually go down that route. To also address your point about why we only have one type of non-financial entity, again, that's the sort of cost-benefit considerations. Sure, we could quite easily go round and look at lots and lots of different industries and develop lots and lots of different illustrative examples, but again, that would be a significant amount of work, and whether we could get the benefits that we want from illustrative examples by just doing a example of a generic non-financial entity. We think we can get those benefits.
Tom?
I support all of these. I'm definitely voting in favor. I just want to remind you a couple of things that have come up in terms of how we do it that I think are worth noting. When I look at the large number of them, I think Mary's point about if we do it within the standard, you want to minimize. And the nice thing about the management commentary is I agree with Gary. I think it is a signal of, you know, it's not mandatory when you put in a management practice statement. It also, a practice statement will allow you to load more in there if you want. It allows you to do more comment about the judgment of choosing how to do it. You could put a lot into a practice statement. So I'm totally in favor, and just as you go through, I think mindful of what Mary said about you may well need, if you go to the practice statement, you probably need at least kind of a basic illustration to help people see things, because I think it'll help a lot if people don't have to just read, but they also have a picture. And then the question of how many, practice statement opens up possibility of more and allows more time. So I'm totally in favor of everything, and just kind of leave it to your discretion as to how to build out the optimal thing as we proceed.
John Wu?
Thank you. I have the same view as Tom and Jin Zhao said. First one is the number of the templates among industries looks a little unfair, because you know all kind of several types of templates for financial entities, but just one template for non-financial entity. So it seems to me we need to a balance between these two. Now that's the one comment I'd like to have. As Tom said, we need to be very careful. Before talking to, are there any, there were templates in IFRS taxonomy more than two? Our IFRS taxonomy is some kind of templates for non-financial and financial, right? Only two types of templates there.
I think it's important to say that there aren't templates in the IFRS taxonomy. The IFRS taxonomy is not designed to be a template. All the IFRS taxonomy does is to reflect the presentation and disclosure requirements of our standards, plus common practice that we've identified in relation to the financial statements. So I think to characterize the taxonomy as a template is not right.
Right, but we have three examples of our taxonomy for non-financial companies and financial.
No.
Just only one taxonomy.
We have a taxonomy. The taxonomy reflects the standards that we have at the moment, and it will reflect the illustrative examples we have in IS1 at the moment. But I don't think it's right to say that we have templates within the taxonomy.
Another thing is that for the statement of financial performance, we are going to have several examples of templates of all different types of the industries. In the case of statement cash flows, we have only two, the financial and non-financial templates. So what I'm saying, if we would like to expand the more detailed templates, then maybe this is another area we need to think about. We need a kind of balance.
Yeah, I think really it's about the point Francoise made earlier to this is goes in tandem with our decisions, with the board's decisions, the scope of subtotals, and, you know, cognizant of the effect we are yet to discuss how this translates into statement of cash flow. So I would take this as a tentative. So I think whatever the outcome of that discussion, how the scope translates to the statement of cash flows will determine, you know, how many variants we need to illustrate, you know, depending on how many different outcomes there are. But the idea is just to illustrate the minimum we need to get the message across of what the board's thinking was.
Mary?
Yeah.
I support the staff recommendations in 2 and 3, but I just wanted to emphasize something that past experience. I think we should be explicit that we are not doing comprehensive examples. They're not comprehensive in terms of all industries. They're not comprehensive in terms of a set of financial statements. They're not even comprehensive in terms of primary financial statements. They are selected examples focused on the statement of financial performance. And to the point about notes, I had to go back and read the text again to realize when we say any notes that are introduced or amended, we're not illustrating the notes. We are saying four specific disclosure requirements we're introducing, we're going to give an example of those. So, for example, the management performance measure reconciliation, because that is going to be in a note. It's not wrong to call it a note, but it makes it sound like we're going to give example footnotes. And the experience I'm referring to is, you know, as I think this team is very aware, the major firms have usually kept at least one, if not many, industry-specific example financial statements. And keeping those current and updated is a non-trivial task when you think about having to update for adoption of amendments to standards, et cetera, et cetera. So I think let's communicate very clearly to the world that even if we put it in manage, you know, even if ultimately we move it into something like a practice statement, that we're doing selected illustrations, not comprehensive examples.
Sue?
excuse me. I agree with the staff recommendations with just a few observations. I guess I see the statements as being slightly different to the notes, even though I agree with your recommendation overall. The reason being, I think before we even started this project, we had in mind the possibility of looking at these examples, if you want to use that word, rather than templates, because of the desire to increase the amount of comparability and to give a steer on disaggregation. So I think it's also helpful that it's a means of illustrating the new proposals. But I think it's got a slightly different purpose to normal. Whereas in contrast, I think it's very common that when we introduce new disclosure requirements, we illustrate those as part of the package of what we publish. So the templates, I think, are something slightly different. Sorry, the examples of the different industries are something slightly different to the notes. I don't think that changes it. I just think that ultimately, if, for example, people came back and said, we think the industry stuff would be better in a practice statement, it may be the case that it would be more natural still for the examples of what these management performance measures look like might sit more naturally in IAS 1 in a different place. But change my idea of the recommendation.
Yeah, and there are unfortunate bit of complications with this decision. Is it practice statement? Is it, you know, accompanying IS-1 because of the decisions we have on what goes in bulk volume, what doesn't, what is paid for, what is free, what
well, the other thing taxonomy. I was going to note is I think that, you know, we're sort of thinking there's no difference between a practice statement and illustrative examples, but I think if we ask that question, we need to think ourselves about what implications that has for the way people adopt IFRS around the world and things like that. The other thing, even though I do agree with the recommendations on balance in terms of the illustrations that you've suggested for the types of entities in paragraph 23, I did sort of stop and think for quite a while about the banking example, surprise, surprise. Because I think it's not that dissimilar to the statement of changes in equity because of the dynamic risk management project. Mm-hmm. In the dynamic risk management project, I think at some point in time we're going to have to think carefully about whether we want to say more about what goes in net interest income. And I'm a little bit worried that by having an example that's got net interest income that's just a very generic interest income, interest expense, we may be encouraging quite a wide reading of what could be in there that we may ultimately want to make adjustments to with DRM. I decided I was being too paranoid, so I think it's fine to use it, but I think it would be good when we have a basis or whatever the document is, to at least acknowledge that there's some interactions with the dynamic risk management project. I think it's still helpful because, despite the fact we really won't be doing anything to add to the consistency of what's in net interest income with what we're doing here, at least it shows the banks how we think the net interest income fits within the sort of broader business profit subtotal. So I think it's useful in terms of explaining the interaction of our proposals.
Thank you. Just developing on what Jin Chao was trying to ask about paragraph 23E and F. You quoted bank for the paragraph 23E and quoted manufacturer for paragraph 23F. And actually, I have a slight concern with the interaction with the decision we made in September. If we follow the September's decision, so paragraph 23E would be the type of entity who would be exempt from providing subtotal. Mm-hmm. And paragraph 23F would be the entities who would not be exempt, both EBIT and some other investment categories. So as a typical example of the companies who would be exempt would be bank, and the typical industry who would not be exempt would be the manufacturer. I had such an impression by reading this example. And actually, there might be some manufacturer or service company or retail company who has both investing and the customer financing as well. And also, there might be some banks who only have just the investing. So therefore, citing the example bank or manufacturer could be misleading because we are just simply following the decision we made in September. If that is the case, I don't think it pick up some category of industry is not a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, we had the feedback in September that our illustrations were not comprehensive. I think it was a point you made, Tom, that, you know, there are other permutations. And I think we agreed that we have a basic principle, and then you can use that principle to permutate as you wish. So I'll just take your feedback on board and, you know, let's consider it. You know, as we said, we don't want to have 20 different ones, but we want to have enough that people can do permutations as necessary. So, yeah, let's work on that.
Okay. Can I see who supports the staff recommendations?
Two and three.
Okay.
13.
Another first. Another one where you're going to agree with all the staff recommendations. So, Nick, pleasure of introducing Nick. Nick Barlow. I can only try, so, try. So 21C, over to you, Nick.
Great, thank you. So paper 21C seeks the board's views on whether it is necessary to clarify or amend some of the line items required to be presented in the statement of financial performance as a result of the board's tentative decisions on the project to date. The staff have identified four potential issues. One, required line items which may need to be presented in more than one section of the statement of financial performance. The second, line items arising from the board's tentative decisions which may not result in useful information. The third, line items arising from the board's tentative decisions which may overlap with existing required line items. And the final point, the interaction of required line items with tentative decisions to require the statement of expenses analyzed either by nature or by function in the statement of financial performance. So before I turn to each of the questions in turn, I just ask if the board has any general comments or questions.
It's just a comment, and so because I understand it's your first intention. So, in your paper, there are, as a background, tentative decisions which are reminded to us that in fact have some ambiguity around them. And that's something that I'm going to, that has an impact on the way I can or cannot answer the question you raise later. So I wanted to flag that out.
Okay, thank you. I'll move to the first issue then. This question relates to the required line items in the Statement of Financial Performance and the incentive decision on subtotals, which have created distinct sections in the Statement of Financial Performance. The staff have identified instances where some of the line items required to be presented in that statement may be required to be presented in more than one section in the same period. To maintain consistency and comparability of each of the subtotals, the staff recommend clarifying that when this occurs, entities would be required to present each item in each section rather than as a single item, line item in a single section. So the question for the board is on page 7, and is, does the board agree with the staff recommendation to clarify that the line items that are required to be presented in the Statement of Financial Performance may need to be presented in more than one section of that statement?
Councilor Azar?
I agree with your recommendation, but I get there in a different manner. So to me, approach 2 is the only one possible, but the reason is that before getting to that point, I mean, I think the disaggregation principles would kick in and require that the line, what you consider being a line item, be already divided. So to me, that's a disaggregation principle that comments approach to. So I agree, but for a different reason. Not it being a choice.
Sue?
I agree. I think it has to be the answer, because otherwise the whole idea that we're splitting between sort of operating, investing, and financing doesn't really work. Because you could have impairment on trade receivables, on investment securities, and on cash and cash equivalents. There has to be three places, assuming it's material.
Okay. Can I see who supports the staff recommendation?
Yeah. 14.
All right, so the second question addresses the presentation of the line items other finance income and other finance expense in the Statement of Financial Performance. These line items were tentatively decided by the board to be included below the profit or loss before financing and income tax subtotal. They were included to capture items such as interest on defined benefit liabilities or the unwinding of a discount on long-term provision. The staff think that when such items are material, it would not be useful to present them as other. And when they are not material, it would not be useful to present them separately. Therefore, the staff recommend that the line items other finance income and other finance expenses not be added to the list of items required to be presented in the Statement of Financial Performance. So the second question for the board on page 8 is, does the board agree with the staff's recommendation not to add other finance income and other finance expenses to the list of line items required to be presented in the Statement of Financial Performance?
Mary?
I am not supportive of this recommendation. I'm thinking back to this morning's discussion, and Gary, a comment you made about when we were talking about EBITDA, mm-hmm. how people from Treasury are distinguishing between financing costs on, let's say, debt versus unwinding of discounted provisions at whether it's pension, decommissioning. Other types. And I think if we take, I agree that other is not particularly descriptive, but I think if we take out the other, then we will be implying that they can either go in other sections, of the Statement of Financial Performance, or be aggregated with the lines that we are specifying. So I think I would rather keep other or invite the staff to be as creative as possible in coming up with, another title for them, but making the point that if some of these items are material, either quantitatively or qualitatively, it might not be appropriate to aggregate them with other items that don't fall into, I was trying to avoid the word other and I just couldn't come up with something. But I think it sends the wrong message to take out that other line item, because we don't want them included, aggregated with the line items that you're suggesting that we keep, and we don't want them moved into into other sections of the statement of financial performance.
Sure. So if I could maybe just respond quickly. So I don't think the intention was to take them out of the definition. So I think they would remain in the definition. So I think that makes it clear that they would still, if they arise and were material, would need to be included in that section. We're just proposing that they would not be required to be included in that section as other. And so when they were material, we would expect they would be in that section. But
if they were individually, let's say you might say the pension amount is not so either large or qualitatively important that you feel it must be presented separately mm-hmm. on the statement of financial performance, I would want it included in other. I would not want it on the basis of it's not big enough to be presented individually. I would not want it aggregated with interest income from cash and cash equivalents. Sue would come after you with a hatchet. I would not want it in cash, from financing activities. I would not want it in expenses from financing activities. So I think at a minimum, we would need to specify a line item other that is a catch-all for these items, unless they are so large that they need to be presented separately.
Yeah, we didn't see it exactly that way. I mean, we considered the risks, as you say, by not specifying it as a separate, but we felt this is really around items that users must see. And what we are trying to avoid in this project is describing things that preparers describe as other today. So we just felt like we are, shooting our own message by having proposals on disaggregation that avoid use of other, excessive use or inappropriate use of other, and yet describe items as other. And we were comfortable on the basis that, decision, to Nick's point, decision on what is in the sections and definition of expenses from financing activities remains. The board has made those decisions. From those decisions, it is clear that interest on pensions, unwinding of discount on provisions, does not fall within expenses from financing activities. And therefore, we thought it's kind of a natural consequence that to the extent these are material, entities would present them separately because they do not fall. They do not we define expenses from financing activities, and these do not meet that definition. So we thought we can manage it that way. But I hear you.
I agree with not listing each one of those and saying subject to materiality. I agree with not spelling out each of them, but I think you need a parking place for them. And so that's. I mean, I think we're understanding each other, which is the main point of it.
I think there's a bit of a tension here as well, because the list of minimum line items we have are not a comprehensive list of everything that you would want to be separately disaggregated. And whilst we would completely agree that we would want to see these other finance income and expenses disaggregated if material from any other type of the line items, I think it's I think just introducing an other finance income, other finance expense category sort of seems a bit odd in the context of it not being a comprehensive list.
It does, except that if they are not individually material, I still would object to and think it was an error to aggregate them with one of A through D. That's the thing. And I think we send the signal that you don't have to split them out.
I mean, Francois, in previous discussion, mentioned field testing, and we had our illustrative examples with this other, and this is the one that there's always so much discussion, debate. What is this?
What's the staff's intention? So, in response to Mary's concern, which is that if we're silent, does that mean that people can add these items to these more pure line items, if you like, in this section?
You're going to see a clutter in your IFRS 9.
Where do you think it's going to go?
My assumption is that the principles that we have around disaggregation would be that they would be disaggregated. So you wouldn't combine them with things that have different natures, which is the other types of finance income there. So I would expect to see them separately. It just, to me, seems quite odd to have a minimum line item of other finance income.
And not only principle, expense. But definition, because we have defined what is expenses from.
So you're not disagreeing with Mary. You're just saying you don't want to have an official required line item coming from us that starts with the word other.
Yes.
But you'd be happy to spell out that doesn't mean that you can stick them in the wrong line item.
If they're material, yeah.
Françoise.
Well, I'm I must say, I'm going to start with that. I mean, I'm very happy if we don't require something that is called other, or that we don't even suggest that it could be called other. It's a comment I made in the past. So now I would like to restart from the beginning, because I agree that what we had done in the past was to describe what would be below. But I don't think we ever came to defining minimum line items. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not in agreement with having four or five line items. When I look at how the distinctions are being presented and justified, for the distinction between what is arising from cash equivalent, using the effective interest method, so I guess it's cash equivalents, distinct from other income. You refer to paragraph 82A I of IS1. That refers to a segregation of a revenue number. So I think it's more something that relates to the interest income that we were referring to when discussing the examples of what a banking income statement would look like. But I don't think that requiring this as minimum line item in the financing income, so that arises from the treasury that I invest temporarily in my financing category, would be if by applying our disaggregation principles, an entity would get to that conclusion, fine, but I would certainly not require that as a minimum line item. So if it is clear, and I'm sensitive to the comments that Mary has made, because to me, minimum line items never meant, especially with the very short list that we've had so far, never meant that whatever would I would not identify, I would necessarily put somewhere in one of those minimum line items. So I would expect that our disaggregation principles are good enough to not get there. But if there is a danger, as identified by Mary, I would prefer mentioning interest expense arising from unwinding liabilities, and because basically that's what we have in mind. So why not?
But there could be other things. There could be remeasurement. Interest expense is probably the most common thing, but you know there could be remeasurement as well. So it would, even if you describe it like that, it wouldn't be complete. So can I just comment on your first point?
I guess then we're not really clear with what we are doing.
So maybe just with the first point, as I understand your concern, why do we need interest income on cash and cash equivalents calculated using effective interest method? To be honest, if we disagree with that, then we are disagreeing with question one, with which I thought everyone agreed, because in question one we asked you items that are minimum line items today, to the extent they appear in different categories, do we want to keep the requirement to present them separately? And, you know, interest income arises from using effective interest method, arises from that paragraph that you just quoted, that, you know, you have to separate interest income or interest income calculated using effective interest method. So it's kind of a natural consequence of that. So I'm not quite sure how this relates now to the discussion we just had on question one.
That's opening a broader question. That was an amendment specifically brought in by IFRS 9 that's just been affirmed by the Interpretations Committee. So that's opening something that already exists in the standards.
Because what's your point, Francois, that whilst this is important to the extent it is in the operating profit, it is perhaps less significant for those for whom it is in the financing section, and therefore you don't think it is as important as to be a minimum line item when it appears in the financing section. Is that what you meant with the comment on interest income here?
Yeah, it's exactly what I mean.
I just said, that would be effectively reopening decisions that were made when we were developing IFRS 9. So, we weren't intending to go through and sort of reanalyze all of the minimum line items that we already have here to see whether we think they were appropriate.
218 Blue Book, Pudite. I'm asking whether because, you know, 82A is and I read it with the little I. This is refers to a disaggregation of a revenue line.
My understanding, and Sue can probably help me on this, is that the revenue was actually intended to cover broadly all income, all interest income.
Interest is always referred to in IFRS 9 as income.
As revenue, sorry.
Mm-hmm. So we need to be really careful because we're now interpreting something that's just been addressed by the Interpretations Committee. But the staff paper just repeats the existing requirement in IAS 1.
But it would be good if we could read it directly from our books,
or we can.
Yeah. Mary? I'm just listening to this, just trying to be helpful, so erase it if it's not. But I think this discussion is bringing home to me the distinction between minimum line items and required disaggregation. And I'm wondering how much the discussion that you're trying to have us have is really guidance that we should be expressing largely about required disaggregation. In other words, that we're trying to say each of these things are items that cannot be aggregated. The only reason for which they could be aggregated is if they were immaterial and therefore could be included in other. That isn't saying you have to have a minimum line item that has zero or trivial amount next to it. But what we all share is a belief that if you have this, you cannot aggregate it. You cannot aggregate other income from cash and cash equivalents with expenses from financing activities. You have to split them out. So maybe the expression is less about minimum line items and more expressed as guidance on aggregation and disaggregation, i.e., you cannot aggregate these things as we have concluded that they are sufficiently different in nature. And therefore, the only way you could aggregate them at all is if they were small enough to fall into. So I kind of, if you have to go away and think about that, that's...
I think there's a tension there because we have the general principles about aggregation and disaggregation and saying that you shouldn't be aggregating things that are dissimilar. We then have this list of minimum line items, which basically says if this item is material, you're going to have to present it separately. Yes. And I think what we're saying is that for the ones that we're recommending here to add to the minimum list of minimum line items, we think that if they are material, we want to see them presented separately. And that's all we're saying.
I was just trying to say that as you cannot aggregate them if they are material.
Yes.
Gary?
Actually, I agree with the staff's recommendations and for bits and bobs of the reasons expressed around here. I think Mary's last comment sort of encapsulated what I was going to recommend is that is they're not a minimum line item, but they would be if they're material and they can't be aggregated if they're not. I think that sort of serves the purpose. I think when you look at all the minimum required line items that we've got, the list is getting long and long. I think we got to look for opportunities to minimize it. Really, reflecting my background in a commercial company, you look at all the line items, you think the financial statement's all about financial instruments and interest income and interest expense. That's the predominant characteristics of the minimum line items that we've got. And I think it's a bit over the top. I agree that if for 18, the items in 18D and 18E, they belong in that section and the tee up or the definition of that section to make very clear items that fit there belong there, unless they are truly immaterial. In which case you can aggregate them with something else in that section. I think the thing is the feedback I get when you talk to people, in spite of all the changes we made a few years ago and the IS-1 changes about, materiality always supersedes the words minimum, shall, and so on, that really has not caught on yet. If we say at a minimum, it's more, many parts of the world going to read that is the requirement, and that is not trumped by materiality or the immaterial guidance we've had. We've tried many times. I think we're going to keep pushing at that for a long, long time, but we're not there yet. So I support the staff's recommendations, subject to, you know, my comments as made.
Okay. Sue.
I also support the staff's recommendation, subject to the sort of clarifications that both Mary and Gary have made. Could I ask you a different, slightly different question? So if I had foreign currency gains or losses or changes in fair value on liabilities that were measured at fair value, would they be? Would I be right in understanding that they'd be included either in 18, what we've got in 18B or 18C, depending on whether they were gains or losses, they'd be in those line items?
Yeah, I think that's exactly correct. The expectation is that it would follow whatever the underlying asset or liability is. Well, in this case, liabilities, but I'm thinking also to the investment section, you might have asked yeah. along the same
lines. If it was an asset, it might be up in the investing exactly. section or even in the... Even in your sort of business profit section, if it was related to a trade receivable or something like that. Okay. So it's not in these other finance income and other finance expense line items. That's not what we're thinking.
Well, sorry, just to follow up on that. Many companies run that. We heard this at GPF on a net basis. They won't effectively disaggregate that.
I wasn't meaning disaggregated. I meant whatever the sort of net result was, it would be in one of those items. foreign currency gains and losses, for example, on their own debt.
I think GPF point was.
What do you mean between the assets and the liabilities?
They run a central treasury forex function. They can't split out the impact from what comes from operations, from what's investing, from what's in financing.
That's interesting for our splits, then, isn't it?
That's what they told us.
To Sue's question, this is how. What the board intended, or this is how we interpret the intentions, but as Nick says, we had a feedback from GPF that it might not be practicable, so we are now one of the tasks now to do this is to consider whether there are ways we can help with that.
But something to pick up on the testing that Françoise has been talking about.
Mm-hmm. Okay, can I see who can support the staff's recommendation?
11. The third question addresses the current required line item finance costs, which overlaps with what the board ostensibly decided to require below profit loss before financing and tax subtotal. So the items we've just been discussing, the staffs think that the line items required to be presented below the subtotal capture those that are currently presented within finance costs, making this a redundant line item. The staff therefore recommend that the board remove it as a required line item. So question 3 on page 9, does the board agree with the staff's recommendation to remove the requirement in paragraph 82B of IAS 1 to present finance costs in the statement of financial performance?
Or 10. Okay.
Very good.
All right, moving right along. So the fourth and final question addresses the interaction of the required line items and the board's tentative decision to require the analysis of expenses in the statement of financial performance to be either by nature or by function. The question relates only to instances when an entity is required to present a line item in the operating section of the statement of financial performance that meets the description of a natural line item, but the entity otherwise presents its analysis of expenses by function. Requiring the presentation of a natural line item within a functional presentation may be seen as contradicting the board's tentative decision to present expenses either by nature or by function. The main required line item which this may occur with in operating profit is expected to be the impairment losses arising from IFRS 9 on accounts receivable. The staff thinks that the usefulness of the information provided by the line items required to be presented in the statement of financial performance, such as impairment, outweighs the potential perceived inconsistency that may result when natural line items are required to be presented within a functional analysis. The staff therefore recommend clarifying that required line items shall be presented regardless of the method of analysis of expenses. So question 4 on page 12 for the board is, does the board agree with the staff's recommendation to clarify that line items required to be presented in the statement of financial performance shall be presented separately regardless of the method of analysis of expenses in the operating profit section?
Mary.
Nick, I think it's helpful to have your comment about the only place that the staff sees this being an issue is impairment losses on trade receivables. But I feel that we should either adopt a by nature of function or we should not. And if remembering that it's not a free choice, but rather what we said is it's a facts and circumstances analysis of which provides the most useful information. If you conclude that a by function is more useful to users of the financial statements, I would prefer to say you still have to disclose that item, but I would accept it being in a note as opposed to on the face. Otherwise, I think we should just give up and say mandate by nature for the analysis of operating. I mean, it's not as big a deal if it's limited to this one item being the intersection, but I still feel like we're kind of backtracking.
Yeah, I would just clarify this. I think that's the most commonly expected item. I think when we move things around in the proposals for financial instruments, yeah, you might find other items. Now, again, a financial entity is unlikely to present by nature, but I have seen instances of investment companies that do by function, and you could theoretically have more items that would conflict there.
Martin.
Yeah, I would prefer approach two. And that is also when, after the last GPF meeting, there was a strong message from GPF that many entities who have by function expenses, they don't have the information by nature, and it would be very, very costly to provide this information.
Martin, I understood that was a different point made.
Sorry?
I thought it was a different point made by GPF. And I'm missing the link between approach two and GPF.
Approach two is do not require presentation of natural line items for expenses in the operating profit section for entities that use by function. My understanding is that we don't require then by nature presentation either in the or in the notes.
It's not. This is
not. I'm agreeing with me.
Yeah, but because this is about required minimum, because required minimum line items are by nature, and this is only dealing to the extent we have required minimum items that is by nature, and this item belongs in the operating profit, but entity, this determines that by function analysis is more useful. What does it mean for this required line item? This is not going back into the question if entity determines analysis of expenses by function is more useful. It needs to provide analysis by nature. That requirement the board has decided on, and that remains. I take your point. We had some feedback on that, and we are kind of thinking about what we need to do, whether we anything with that feedback, but this is a different point.
And I misunderstood approach two, because my understanding was approach two that we don't require in that by nature.
No, what approach two means is simply to say if you have presentation of expenses by function, you don't need to present impairment losses on face, for example.
I thought it would be for asset here.
Beryl. So I agreed with what Mary was saying, and I just wanted to then clarify where we were ending up, which I think is a little bit of the discussion that's happened. So the way I thought about it was that we would not, if we followed what Mary was suggesting, we would not be presenting, let's say, impairment losses at the moment on the face, but if it was considered important enough in another standard to present it, it would go in the notes. And I think I would be in agreement with that answer. I would not be in agreement with saying you don't present it anyway.
The reason we did not recommend that approach is we felt this kind of undermines the board's decisions in the other projects where you decide item is important enough to be on the face. And then, in addition, it puts a pressure on the decision whether I do by function or by nature analysis. And we didn't think really these two were so interconnected that it should matter. And it was, they could be presented separately. We think overall the balance would be right, but yeah, that's a question.
The same point Mary and Daryl mentioned. So suppose impairment on financial instrument is separated into cost of sales and the SGA. In that case, if we follow what the paragraph 36 says, the information would be missed if we go to the approach one. But as Mary pointed out, disaggregation information is necessary. So if that is the case, entity can disaggregate the impairment or information into cost of sales part and SGA part, like we required in the issue one. We ask separate presentation, so we can ask separate presentation in the cost of sales and the SGA. And come back to the Martin point, for other expense like labor cost, it's quite difficult to segregate. But I don't think it's difficult to segregate, to disaggregate impairment on financial instrument, which belongs to SGA, which belongs to cost of sales. So we can simply require,
That's still approach one, because it means that they shall be presented separately on the face, but to the extent that they're allocated between different functions, they would be, that allocation would be presented within function.
On the face.
Yeah. Okay. Although with impairment example, my understanding, and maybe Gary, you can correct me, that it's unlikely to be in cost of sales, but, you know.
Yeah, it's unlikely, yeah. Mm-hmm. So the problem is not really serious, but you know, but because paragraph 36 says information will be lost, but, it's not necessarily. We can simply ask.
Yeah, but the approach two is different.
I'm not talking about approach two. Approach one.
Yeah.
Gary.
I agree with the staff. Support approach one. I think we're talking two different things here. You got a general, two general models, a by function and by expense, and it, which, you know, may or may not be applied precisely in practice exactly as written. But I think all we're saying in approach one is if in some other standard, in some other project, we said something is important enough to be on the face, is, but almost certainly that's a by nature item, is. But if it's important enough to be in the face, it's important enough to be in the face regardless of a model that's by function or a model that's by nature. I think the specificity of board decisioning over time that said it should be in its own line item, I think should prevail over some general models that are there that are still being developed a bit in this project and certainly are not pristinely applied in practice. I think it's generally a mixed model. So I fully support approach one.
François.
I support approach one as well, and but I disagree with the implication that we should, by function presentation, necessarily force allocation of whatever expense arises in the course of the period to one function. So I understand it's described as an implication. I went back to the papers, and I agree it can be an implication. But I don't agree, because I think it will work against both very important qualities, which are relevance and comparability. I think if we force, an item like an impairment of trade receivables to be hidden on the face, not knowing where it has been allocated to, because people could decide, well, that's the sales that have not selected the right customer, but then some others would say, no, that's general management expense. So anyway, you have also a lack of comparability, and you don't have any information on what goes where. So, and we have already identified that it's the supplementary information that we're going to provide, I mean, requiring the notes is the expense, the statement of expense by nature. So not telling you what is where. So I think we have to first respect the decisions made when in other projects it's been decided that information was important in the face, but also let entities be in a position of identifying what would be better singled out on the face of the income statement. when it is not a cost, you know, that is inherent, that is necessary to carry out a function. And I don't think that you need, you know, litigation costs or provision for restructuring in order to achieve a selling effort or to produce your goods. So forcing these kind of items into the cost of functions to me is just providing bad information.
So you are agreeing with approach one.
I wanted to because I approved of the definition that we gave without necessarily having anticipated all implications that we have. And in fact, when we did, I highlighted several times that I think we had to be careful not to have to. In fact, the allocation of expenses by function would not be exhaustive.
I mean, that's a different point, if we can maybe take that.
Yeah, I know it's a different point, but, you know, I voted in favor at the time, so I have, at a point in time, at this table, said that I really disagree with that.
And maybe just to clarify, our intention is, I think, consistent with what you're saying. We don't want to force entities to put this into functional categories, but at the same time, I don't think the way the staff has intended this recommendation would prohibit entities from doing so. So if in tax example, entity felt it was useful to allocate items such as impairment costs between different functional categories, providing that that information is all within primary financial statements, then I think they would be able to do that, but we would not be requiring based on the recommendation.
Nick?
I assume as a minimum line item, it wouldn't get lost if it's on the face. It would be very visible, actually, so I don't have concerns about it being lost in that respect. I'm kind of agnostic in terms of whether it should be allocated or not. You may just find pragmatically it ends up in SG&A. As long as it's visible, that's probably fine for me. I'd rather it wasn't tucked away in the notes. I think that's so I support the staff recommendation.
I'm not sure I understand the staff recommendation. Maybe I'm just thick, but when I read paragraph 36, I didn't understand it, where it says it could not be allocated to functional categories. So is what you're saying in approach one that if a particular expense is all included, say, in... Does approach one mean that if I've included all of a particular thing that's required to be a minimum line item in general and administrative expenses, you have to put it on the face and you can see that it's within general and administrative expenses?
Mm-hmm.
Or if for some reason I've got some of that item in one category and one function and some in another, could I not say I've got 60 here and 40 there, as long as I can see it on the face, I've met the minimum line item requirements? And I couldn't understand why we're saying it could not be allocated, because to me those are both. Is it the allocation because it's a notional allocation? I don't understand what 36 is saying they can't do, because I thought approach one was saying you've got your functions, but you've still got to show where these minimum line items are included within the on the face, which to me is a form of allocation. So I didn't understand paragraph 36.
I think the intention here is that you could, along with what was in the first question, that you could split them amongst the various functions. I think the wording has sort of arisen from the looking at it at its current state. You would look, it's a single minimum line item as it stands today, and looking at it in that context.
We've already said it could be in more than one place.
We have now, yes. And so when this
was... that, does 36 not apply anymore?
I think that...
can say that, yes.
In which case, I do support approach one.
Yeah.
Okay. That's a good time.
Can I see who supports that recommendation?
12.
Thank you.
We'll be back.
15 minutes break. Right on top.